Summer is upon us, more or less in terms of weather, and yet there's no denying that the summer movie season is indeed in full swing. That's apparent because, one, we've had our first major reboot, The Mummy, and two, because said reboot stars Tom Cruise. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101, and on this week's show, Nathan Weinbinder and I will discuss this new version of The Mummy, plus a mean little horror flick titled It Comes at Night, and we'll catch up by reviewing something that slipped past us when it opened several months ago, Triple X Return of Xander Cage. After all, that flick has summer movie written all over it. Anyway, don't touch that dial because your local window on all things cinematic, Movies 101, is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Hey, it's Fred Newman. You know what comes to my mind when I think of the word sustaining? You're moving, you're going a long way for a long time. You're the one with the map and the directions, and you're in control there because you are a Spokane Public Radio sustaining member. It's a word, sustaining, that leads directly to the future. Sustainers are members who choose to support the programs they value with a long-term commitment. Be a part of SPR's future and become a sustaining member today.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that takes its summer movies as seriously as it does its summer vacations. And speaking of vacations, our resident diva, Mary Pat Truthart, is still trekking through the land of pasta and pizza. So Nathan and I will have to keep the critical fires burning all on our own. This week, those fires will be directed at The Mummy, the first in Universal Pictures' new series of remakes of the studio's greatest horror films. We'll also tackle a more contemporary example of horror, It Comes at Night, before retroactively reviewing a film that we passed on when it was first released several months ago, the Vin Diesel actioner Triple X Return of Xander Cage. First up, the latest version of Mummified Egyptian Evil. With the release of Alex Kurtzman's The Mummy, Universal Pictures announced that it would be reviving a number of the studio's classic horror films under the series title Dark Universe. Let's hope that the follow-ups are better than Kurtzman's film, which, believe it or not, was based on an original screenplay co-written by David Koepp, author of Jurassic Park, and Christopher McQuarrie, who won an Oscar for writing The Usual Suspects. It's not as if The Mummy is the worst film ever made, which you might suspect dictated by its almost universal, no pun intended, panning by critics. It's just that it's not very good, despite state-of-the-art CGI and the presence of none other than Tom Cruise. The very basic plot outline has Cruise playing a maverick-type soldier of fortune who stumbles upon an Egyptian tomb and, teamed with an archaeologist love interest played by Annabella Wallace, spends the entire movie's running time of 1 hour 50 trying to get rich and to fend off the obligatory mummy's curse. Trouble is, Cruise is over his head here, failing miserably in his attempts to play the kind of wisecracking rogue that a young Harrison Ford, or these days, Chris Pine or Chris Pratt, take to so well. And whose idea was it to cast Russell Crowe as Dr. Henry Jekyll, the Henry Jekyll, as a drug-swilling head of some mysterious organization that feels awfully similar to Will Smith's Men in Black group? Turns out that decision is likely part of the larger Dark Universe plan, but it still seems like a silly subplot here.
Well, likely. I don't think you needed to use the word likely because that's clearly what's going on. I have to say this. The trailers for The Mummy have been playing before just about every movie we've seen for the last, what, it feels like 2 years
now.
Yeah,
2 years.
And I thought it looked kind of fun. I like these movies where Tom Cruise basically proves that he's superhuman, that he's got these Scientology superpowers and he can do whatever he wants. I mean, the Mission Impossible movies, the last few, have been really good. And they've coasted on the movie star charisma that he has, but also
But he plays those straight. He doesn't.
It's true. But he also has this weird, it's almost like he's a sociopath. It's almost like he's a sociopath. Because he does these insane stunts. And so I like these big, bloated action movies that he does. It worked really well in Edge of Tomorrow.
Where
he had a bit more of a sense of humor about his movie star persona. And so I thought this looked kind of fun. And I like the idea of bringing back all of these classic Universal monsters. I think it's actually a pretty brilliant idea. And the first 45 minutes or so of The Mummy, I was into in its own kind of B-movie, lesser summer blockbuster way. It's the kind of movie where the entire plot hinges on this enchanted stone that you put into the bottom of this ancient dagger. Yeah. I mean, and it's completely ridiculous. And it kind of knows it's ridiculous, but it also kind of doesn't, which I think the Brendan Fraser Mummy movies did really well, too.
Speaking of movies that were much better. One, absolutely.
The first Mummy reboot with Brendan Fraser and Rachel Weisz, I think, holds up as a really good example of this kind of blockbuster cheese that this movie tries and ultimately fails to be, because there's this big action set piece. It's a complete showstopper in which they're in northern Iraq.
Right.
And they come across a tomb that looks like an Egyptian tomb. And they say, what's this doing here? We're in Iraq. Used to be Mesopotamia. But why is there an Egyptian tomb here? They find a pool of liquid mercury with a sarcophagus at the bottom of it. Looks like somebody was trying to keep that sarcophagus down there, but they yank it up anyway. And pretty soon they've got the titular mummy on this airplane, and its curse comes to life, and the plane eventually crashes. And that sequence is really good.
It's straight out of one of the Mission Impossible movies.
It absolutely is.
Yeah.
And the way that the camera moves around, and the way that Cruise and Annabelle Wallace kind of float through in like zero gravity, I was really into it. And then the moment where Russell Crowe comes in, and maybe even quite a ways before Russell Crowe comes in, that's when I realize what this movie is really trying to do, which is not to be an entertaining B-movie, but to set up this monotonous universe. I mean, why do we need them to sit down and explain what's going on here? Yeah. It's a mummy movie.
Explain more than once.
Yeah, multiple times. And they revealed, I mean, it's not really a spoiler, because if you go on IMDb, it says Dr. Henry Jekyll. When he announced that he was Dr. Henry Jekyll, I said, okay, I'm done giving this movie chances.
Really.
Because it really goes down the tubes pretty fast.
Yeah. And like I say, it's not that it's a really bad movie.
It's not as bad as the reviews suggest. Would you agree?
I do agree. But it's just not very good. And so consequently, it's another one of these instances in which they're trying to sell us a bill of goods. It's like, oh, come, you're going to really love it. Well, no, I didn't really love it. I didn't really like it either, but I didn't hate it. It's just a waste of time. And when you have movies like this that are really good, the original Mummy, as we pointed out, the Brendan Fraser, Rachel Weisz one, or any of the other movies that are done. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, we talked about that. I didn't think it was as good as the original. You thought it was better than the original.
Yeah.
Either way, it's Citizen Kane compared to the Mummy.
For sure.
You know, and I understand
it's Citizen Kane and the Magnificent Ambersons combined.
Right.
Compared to this.
I can't believe that these guys, these screenwriters who are proven screenwriters, are responsible for this.
Yeah, you know, when I saw their names pop up at the beginning, I thought, okay, well, maybe.
You know, it was taken out of their hands, and some producers said, hey, you know, we don't
or
care
Tom
about
Cruise.
This movie. Maybe so. And he, to me, is the other really big problem with this film.
Hmm.
Everybody else is okay. Jake Johnson is okay for the three and a half seconds he's in
Cruise's kind of Tomb Raider
sidekick.
Buddy. And he gets killed off pretty early and keeps popping up in this decomposed state,
like
which
Griffin
reminded
Dunway.
You of American Werewolf in London.
Complete
rip off of that.
Yeah.
No, he's fine. And Sophia Boutella, who plays the mummy, she was previously in that Kingsman movie. I thought she was good. She looks good as a mummy. It was interesting that it was a female mummy, although they make her like a sort of sexy female mummy, which is just completely stupid. But I thought that she pulled off a pretty nothing role.
85,000 tattoos.
Yeah. We keep talking about the mummy as being not very good. Wouldn't you have rather this been a complete disaster, like a complete laughable joke of a movie, as opposed to a competently made but ultimately vapid and pointless and mostly forgettable movie?
You know what? I would have loved this movie probably had Bruce Campbell played the role rather than Tom Cruise.
Because he's got a swagger to him,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. He brings a certain feel to a movie role, and he's quite good in the Mission Impossible movies. I'll grant him that. But he just can't do this. He can't. Maybe he can. I mean, there have been movies in which he can play humorous, but he can't play a young Harrison Ford.
No.
Only Harrison Ford could play that.
Sure.
And today, I mean.
And this character is clearly an Indiana Jones clone. I mean,
they're
not even trying to hide it. He calls himself a liberator of antiquities or something like that. And it's like, oh, right. So you're a tomb raider, essentially.
Right.
I think the problem here, though, it's not even the fact that this movie is mostly phoned in, which it really is. I think the problem is, and this feels to me like a new trend in Hollywood. I could be mistaken, but I don't think I am. This idea that they put the cart before the horse in terms of franchise filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
So we see at the beginning, it says Universal Studios, and then the globe turns and it says Dark Universe.
Yeah.
And we've read, you know, in all the trades mm-hmm. that this is the new thing. They're going to do Bride of Frankenstein. They're going to do Creature from the Black Lagoon. Mm-hmm. And the moment when Russell Crowe comes in, the movie stops dead in its tracks
yes.
to let him explain what's going on. And we see little hints of Dracula and all these other Universal
the
characters.
Wolfman, yeah.
The Wolfman, yeah. And instead of being kind of wowed by it and thinking, oh, this is going to be interesting, I thought, well, we have to deal with this now? Like, what about the mummy? And it
yeah.
doesn't, it feels so tacked on.
Right.
And basically what they're doing, and they recently did this with the Guy Ritchie King Arthur film, which was a huge flop. And yet the studio put it out thinking it would be the first in a 6-film series.
Mm-hmm.
How much misplaced confidence do you have to think that people are going to come and see 6 King Arthur movies
yeah.
and to think that before the first one even goes to camera. Mm-hmm. And so basically what they're doing is they are telling us that we're going to get this franchise
yeah.
whether we want it or not.
And let's face it, they're not making movies for you or me anymore.
No.
I mean, even
I don't think they're making movies for anybody.
No, I think they're making movies for an international audience. They're hoping
because this movie did better overseas than it did here.
Sure it did. So did the other movie we'll be talking about later, XXX Xander Cage.
Oh, did
because
it?
It has Tony John and Donnie
Yen. That's true.
Yen.
It's a very international cast, right.
But we'll get to that. We just finished talking about The Mummy. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at It Comes at Night and XXX Return of Xander Cage. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio. And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I discussed The Mummy. Let's now move to a couple of other movies, one a kind of dystopian horror titled It Comes at Night, and the other the latest in a Vin Diesel action series, this one titled XXX Return of Xander Cage. Let's begin with things that go bump in the night. There's so much I like about It Comes at Night that my disappointment over its lack of what, for me, was a satisfying ending feels particularly, perhaps unfairly, emphatic. In one sense, It Comes at Night contains all the stuff of contemporary horror, with the world threatened by a mysterious incurable disease, a family of 3 barricades itself in a remote house. They've already disposed of one sick relative, so when one night someone comes knocking at their locked door, the family is understandably on edge. But it's just a solo man who is looking for supplies and a place to stay for his own wife and child. Pretty soon, both families are living together with peace reigning for the moment, even if a sense of unease lingers. In a whole other sense, though, It Comes at Night, despite its B-movie title, is essentially a tale of human weakness, of what fear and distrust can cause people to do when their very survival is at stake. Writer-director Trey Edward Schultz has talent behind the camera. His film begins and proceeds with only the slimmest of exposition, and the house the characters dwell in feels creepy and claustrophobic at once, the mundane moments broken by sudden violence punctuated by a jarringly effective musical score. It's only when Schultz gets cute with dream sequences and a bit of repressed sexual tension that the straightforward plot gets, to me, too convoluted, which leads to that ending that left me, for one, cold.
Well, I want to get to the ending eventually, which we won't spoil, but I think we have to...
No, we can't spoil it.
We have to deal with it in some way because I completely disagree with you about whether or not it works. But I do want to mention those dream sequences, which are there because the young son of the main couple, Joel Edgerton and Cameron Ajogo, who are the ones that live in this really nice kind of sleek modern house, but it's been kind of closed off and they only live in a couple of rooms, which I thought was an interesting kind of subversion of the house in the woods kind of trope.
All right.
Their son, who's 17 years old and has, because of this plague, which we never really find out exactly what's going on with that, has seen some things. We really go into his mind. If anything, he's sort of the protagonist.
We see the movie through his mind.
Yeah, 100%. And those dream sequences become part of the story as the film goes on. And I agree with you. They feel like shock moments. It's the closest the movie ever gets to being a horror film, and yet it turns out to be it was only a dream. And I really resent the it's only a dream trope anyway.
Right.
So when the movie keeps trotting them out, there is a point, though, where we wonder if what we're seeing in his dreams is maybe not a dream,
right?
And I thought that when he played around with reality in that way, it worked. But when you see him sit bolt upright in bed, it's like, okay, whatever.
Yeah.
But on to the ending of It Comes at Night, which, again, we're not going to spoil. I thought the ending had this really terrific, sobering quality because we know that this movie isn't going to end well. I mean, from what we understand, most of the world's population has been decimated, or at least the country's population has been decimated, just based on context clues that we get throughout the film. There are only so many people left, and the people that are left are desperate and clinging for survival.
And they're killing each other,
They're killing each other. I mean, it's kill or be killed, right? And this plague is apparently unbelievably easy to catch. And
yes.
So they're mostly walking around
and
in gas masks.
And it takes an afternoon for it to...
To full-blown plague,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
When the movie does get to its ending, I admired the fact that Schultz didn't pull any punches. I mean, this is a film, it's being marketed as a horror film. And I think that is a mistake. I think it's going to get people into the theater, but I think people are going to be resentful of what the movie turns out to be, which is this movie about paranoia, both justified and questionable, because
right. The
Joel Edgerton character, it makes sense why he's so protective of his family, but to what lengths will he go to protect his family? At what point does it become assault and not protection, right? And I thought the way the movie examined that was interesting. I wish the characters had come more into focus because they really feel like they're very flat. I mean, Schultz has kind of a Kubrickian way with actors in which he never really lets us into, other than the 17-year-old son, never really lets us into their head. I think that's a deliberate choice. I think he kept them at arm's length from us on purpose. But there are all these moments where you expect the characters to become real people and they never do.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that was his way of examining the fact that this situation has kind of deadened them, that they don't have personalities anymore. They're defined by their own survival. But they didn't feel like real people to me. But the ending of It Comes at Night, I thought it's a total gut punch. And I think it works. And the very last shot, it's one image of two characters on screen and they don't say anything and you knew exactly what happened off screen.
Right.
You know exactly what they're thinking about. And I thought that that was a really powerful moment.
Well,
the most powerful moment in the film.
I didn't mind that, but it's so difficult to talk about this without talking about the specifics. Let's just say it didn't make sense to me. It made sense, as you say, what they were thinking, looking at each other at that point. Yeah, that all made sense. And some horrible stuff that happens at the end, it all made sense too. But there's a lead up to that that doesn't make sense. It's like, well, this happened. Who did this? What? I don't know. It's never answered. There's not enough answers.
Right. But that's what's so great about it, because he leaves you with questions. He's clearly channeling two movies here. He's channeling The Shining. I mentioned Kubrick earlier, and that's obviously what he's channeling here. And The Thing, in the sense that you can't really trust anybody in this scenario. And so something happens at about, what, the midway point, maybe a little bit after that. And when I tell you that this movie goes to dark places, I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
It goes further than I expected it to. And shockingly and suddenly, the incident that is basically the linchpin here is never explained. And I think that adds a certain level of horror to it, because we walk out of the movie going, well, who opened the door? I don't think that's giving anything away. Who opened the door?
Yeah.
It's never answered.
Who unlocks it? It
you know, what happened there? And I think the fact that he is confident enough in this material to leave that unanswered, it's kind of sticking in our craw. I think that's what makes the ending so powerful because it shows that without sorry, I'll let you answer it, but without explaining it, it makes us wonder, was a certain – yeah, it is hard to talk about this. Was a certain character justified in a thing that they did because of that? Yeah, I can't
I'm going to spoil it.
This
is good. If you were Bob Glatzer, you wouldn't have any problem.
No,
you'd be just
I would
have
spoiled
it.
I'm not going to spoil the movie.
I want to go back and how I began my piece on this. There's so much about this movie I liked. I really liked how this guy just threw us in these people's lives and just said, you know, catch up. There it is. There they are.
Yeah.
So, and you have to. And you learn about these people. And it didn't bother me that I didn't know really what the problem was. Or everything I needed was right there. But then he gave too much. In the dream sequences, he started throwing it around. And then that confused me. And at the very end, we're seeing it all through one character's eyes. And then there's a switch there, too. So
I think we're both positive about this. It's not a crowd-pleasing movie. And I recommend, too, that if you liked this, this is the second film by writer-director Trey Edward Schultz. His debut was a film that came out last year called Krisha, which is also about a dysfunctional family stuck in one house during a particularly tumultuous Thanksgiving. And the way he uses his camera, the way he uses music, you can see it all right there. So this is a guy to watch, though.
Yeah.
I think
no,
we can agree
doubt
to that.
About that. Yeah. And that was It Comes at Night. Let's close with XXX Return of Xander Cage.
What a
segue. We were introduced to the character of Xander Cage in the original XXX, a 2002 action film directed by Rob Cohen, in which our hero is sent to infiltrate a posse of Russian-speaking terrorists, leading to some of the most enjoyable, over-the-top dialogue and action sequences I'd seen in a long time. Remember, that was 15 years ago. Years later, X has faked his death and gone underground so he can apparently live the life of an extreme athlete, yada, 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 before being brought back ever so reluctantly into the NSA fold. This time he is sent after something called the Pandora's Box, a MacGuffin that gives its owner the power to convert any satellite revolving around Earth into a guided missile. Along the way, following a script filled with one double cross after the next, it is called XXX. Xander is joined by the likes of international action stars Donnie Yen and Tony Jaa, which both ensures that at least some of the cast members will be able to pull off believable fight scenes and that the movie will appeal to audiences in such markets as far away as Hong Kong and Thailand. But director DJ Caruso, a veteran of such films as Eagle Eye and I Am Number 4, never finds a way to capture the gleefully carefree joy of what Cohen managed to create those 15 years ago. This Xander Cage should have stayed underground.
I'm going to cop to something here. I saw this movie when it first came out back in January. I actually went to the theater and saw it because I got a free movie ticket offered. And so I went and saw it and promptly forgot about it. And then I think just a couple nights ago, Dan sent me four or five movie titles and said, which of these have you seen?
Because these were all movies that I saw on my flight to Europe and back. And so this was one of them. And this was the one Nathan hated the least. So
yeah.
That's why.
So basically we're reviewing this because Dan watched it on an airplane.
Oh, and it's a summer movie too.
He had so many, it was a summer movie that came out in January. So yeah. I'm just going to say that I don't remember much about this. The part that I remember the most from XXX, what's it called? I almost said XXX State of the Union, but that was the one with Ice Cube. Return of Xander Cage. They don't even have the time for the Return of Xander Cage, just Return of Xander Cage. The part that I remember the most is when he's on like a bike, like a motorcycle, and he jumps into the water and it turns into a jet ski.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
look, you know, the part I remember
is
how aghast I was that he's supposed to be a babe magnet. You know, come on, Vin Diesel, please.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense that they brought this movie back now, or this franchise back now. But the cast is good. If you're on a plane and you don't have any other option.
Precisely.
I don't know why we're reviewing this.
I don't know.
Boy, that's the worst review we've ever. I didn't remember the movie. Dan watched it on a plane.
Own it, man. And that was XXX Return of Xander Cage. And this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder and I discussed The Mummy and It Comes at Night. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show. And we thank you to our loyal listeners. And we invite you back next week, same time, same spot in the radio dial, when we'll again brave the world of cinema so that you don't have to. Until then, remember these words from the great Alfred Hitchcock. There is no terror in the bang, only in the anticipation of it. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.